and welcome everyone to the Thursday night training call for the Distributor Rights Association, soon to be, actually, I think, as of tomorrow, marketing professionals. We've got to start getting you used to saying ANMP now. This is your host, Len Clements. I'll be the host of most of these calls as we do these calls in kind of an interview-style format for now. And, again, these calls are every Thursday night. They are free of charge, of course, you know, sponsored by the Association of Network Marketing Professionals, the Prepsee, the DRA, for you as a service to the distributors within the network marketing community and industry. And it'll be same time, same station every Thursday night. So please let your groups know about this. There's no pitching of companies or anything like that, so it's perfectly safe. So please get the word out there and get the attendance up even greater than it's already spiraling up to right now, which is actually kind of fun. It's, the attendance is very, very well so far since the beginning of the year. We really appreciate that. So we're going to get right into this because we only have about an hour. We do try to keep this under an hour with hopefully a little bit of Q&A at the end. So just to kind of get going here, we haven't put an announcement out that Kevin Grimes was going to be our speaker tonight. Actually, Kevin is sick and he's got laryngitis and he can't talk, so doesn't make for the best interview subject. So actually, Kevin's a partner in a law firm called Grimes and Reese. It's, in my opinion, and I think opinion of many other people in the industry, one of the very best and most well-respected law firms that service the network marketing industry. And when you got Grimes and Reese, whether you get Grimes or whether you get Reese, you can't go wrong. So actually, we got Reese. We got Spencer Reese, Kevin's partner, will be on the call filling in for Kevin tonight, which is great because Spencer, I think he's been practicing law for, you'll probably correct me if I got this wrong, about 25 years now. And I think back in 1992, he actually joined the legal department of a very well-known, well-established network marketing company where he was in charge of distributor compliance, corporate regulatory compliance. In other words, he had to deal with the FDA, FTC, state AGs, things like that, a lot of stuff dealing with the companies, intellectual property, that kind of thing. So he's got a lot of experience specifically with the subjects that we want to talk about on this call tonight, especially the, dealing with what's an illegal pyramid scheme and what's not, which is really the theme of the call tonight. He's regularly contributed many, many articles over the years to all of the major trade publications. There's a whole library of him and his partner Kevin's articles at mlmlaw.com. So go to mlmlaw.com. You can check out all of their resources that they have there for everybody. He's now, of course, working with startup companies and established law firms all within the direct sales and network marketing field primarily, although he does deal with other sales marketing companies dealing with supplements and cosmetics and things like that, which will be also one of the subjects we'll be talking about. So with no further ado, Spencer Reese, thank you for being on the call and filling in for your horse partner, Kevin, tonight.
Well, it's a pleasure, Len, and thank you for having me. I hope Kevin gets well soon, and thanks for joining the call, everyone. I hope you find it fruitful this evening.
It's good. That's, I know that there's a lot of kind of hot topics out there right now, Spencer, as far as what people have questions about. I'm sure you get a lot of emails and questions. I get a lot of them, too. So without really, and I kind of made the commitment to everybody out there so they felt safe to come onto the call, that we're not going to talk about any specific companies by name or stay away from any specific, you know, product genre or anything like that. But just in the most macro point of view, I guess, what is the primary delineation between a legal network marketing company and an illegal pyramid scheme?
Well, you bet, Len. That's indeed a very hot topic. And actually, I wish I could make one single delineation, but there's actually a number of factors that go into the mix. And it can get pretty muddy, quite frankly. But let's just really walk through an analysis. I mean, if you want to start from the federal perspective, because we'll look at this from both the federal and the state perspectives. If you want to look at it from the federal perspective, you look at what the standard definition is, and there's really going to be two components. That is that if there's some sort of an investment, and that in exchange for that investment, you get the right to receive commissions or compensation based primarily on recruiting. Now, that's a very simple statement, and one would think that, okay, that's pretty easy to figure out. If something falls within that definition, it's a pyramid scheme. But when you drill down into it, you'll find that it's an incredibly, as I say, muddy and complicated analysis. It used to be that when we were dealing with programs that all they dealt with was inventory, you know, tangible products. You know, we always looked at the inventory loading situation and found out, is the company inventory loading? Are distributors inventory loading? If so, that's a pretty good indication that a pyramid scheme exists. And certainly we still look at that. That's a very important component to the analysis. But from the federal perspective, over the last couple of years, regulators have looked at the network marketing industry and they've figured out, well, you know what? We got a lot of companies that don't sell tangible products anymore. They're either selling services, which is entirely legitimate, or they're selling digital products, which can likewise be legitimate. So there's not necessarily this danger or risk of inventory loading that we have traditionally seen. Yet the risk of a pyramid scheme exists nonetheless, even though there may not be an inventory situation. So the approach that the FTC has taken, most notably in the last big case that they brought, they look and they ask a rather nebulous question, and that question is, are distributors or are people who are participating in the program paying fees that are incidental to participation in the program? And you step back and you look at that and you scratch your head and say, are they paying fees incidental to participation in the program? What does that mean? That's a real head scratcher. So there are a couple of things that we look at to try to answer that question. And mind you, the FTC has not given us a good definition of what constitutes fees that are incidental to participation in a plan. I mean, in my opinion, what that really boils down to is, are we paying for the right to participate in the compensation plan as opposed to purchasing bona fide products or services? So let's just talk a little bit about some of the things that would go into the mix to determine if fees are being paid that are incidental to participation in the comp plan. First, the overall question I ask is the product really just the price of admission to play in the comp plan? I mean, if that's what's going on, if you're just buying a product or buying a service, and the only reason that people are doing it is because that is the quickest and easiest and fastest and best way to qualify for commissions, and they continue to buy the product month after month after month just because they really don't have an interest in the product, but because it gives them access to the comp plan, that is going to be viewed as a fee that is incidental to participation in the comp plan. Now, you know,
and Spencer, that could be perfectly legitimate products, too.
Oh,
products
absolutely.
Of value, like Equinox, for example, since they're gone, we can talk about them. They had great products, but they were still deemed a pyramid because the motive for buying the products, $20,000 worth all up front, which you just threw in your garage, was just to meet a quota in the plan. So you can still have perfectly legitimate products and yet still qualify as a pyramid.
That's exactly right, Lynn. That's exactly right. I mean, now Equinox, obviously, as you indicated, they, you know, threw the products in the garage. That's an inventory loading situation as well. But so it would that case lent itself to a attack as a pyramid on both bases, whether it would be a fee incidental to participation or on the traditional inventory loading analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So they get them coming and going. Actually, the FTC announced this position. I'm trying to figure out what the sequence was, but I believe they didn't announce this position on the fees incidental to participation until after the Equinox case was brought. But let's talk a little bit and let's drill down a little deeper into this, what this fees incidental to participation really means, because there are some things that the FTC will look at and say, yeah, absolutely, that's a fee incidental to participation. And I don't think that some of these are going to come as a surprise to anyone. You know, mandatory product purchases. That's certainly one that the FTC will attack. If a compensation plan or a program requires that you purchase product in order to participate in the comp plan, that's what's known as a pay-to-play program. You got to pay if you want to play. And the FTC has taken the position that those mandatory product purchases constitute fees that are incidental to participation in a compensation plan. Now, you know, let's face it. We can we can pick out just about any network marketing program and say, well, no, they don't require that you purchase products to participate. That's good. But then ask yourself the next question. When the program or the product is pitched, while it may be optional on paper, is it actually required in practice or in fact? Is the product purchase required in fact or in practice? And that's something else the FTC will look at. Other things that they're going to look at is look at the product pricing. And if the product is priced at such a premium to competitive products in the market, then that's going to go into the mix. I mean, why would somebody pay such a premium for this product if it's not really a step above the rest in terms of quality or value? Why would you pay that additional premium unless it was for purposes, unless it was because it gave you access to the compensation plan? Now, that gets into a really, really dicey conversation and discussion, because let's face it, in the network marketing field, we typically see prices that are higher than you're going to find on most retail shelves. Now, you know, we certainly know in the network marketing field that we're not going to go toe-to-toe with Walmart on price. There's no way, nor do we want to. You know, Walmart has typically the lower to mid-grade products, and network marketing programs have typically the higher-end products, and they have to, because we know that we cannot compete with Walmart or the big box stores. But that doesn't mean that we have to be the price leaders. You can have more expensive products so long as the quality of the product justifies it. Now, we can look at, for example, some shampoos that network marketing programs sell are price competitive with the high-end salon shampoos. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, because in that case we're comparing apples to apples. But if you compare it to a top quality salon shampoo, and the network marketing shampoo is still charging a 50% premium, you can ask the question, why is that? Why are they charging that premium? Is it really that much better than the top end salon shampoo?
Yeah, I think Kevin refers to it sometimes as the $1,000 fountain pen.
That's right. That's right.
Right. Is it just there so you have a huge markup to afford the most lucrative comp plan in the industry, or is that fountain pen really worth $1,000?
Exactly. Exactly. So, plug in the product. You always ask yourself that question. And that gets down to the question of, you know, what is the quality and the uniqueness of the product? Fortunately, in the network marketing industry, you'll see that actually we're market leaders in many cases. You look at a lot of the functional beverages that are out there, and they were introduced through network marketing, and after a few years when they got traction, the retail stores figured it out, and they make their knockoff products, and then we see the Johnny-come-latelys coming along. But really, you know, the first to market, they have a certain uniqueness about them that can justify a product upcharge, a premium. But again, you have to ask yourself, at some point, you know, when the competitors come out, there has to be some price variability there. You know, you have to respond to the competition. And again, you try to compare. In fact, you have to compare the quality of the store brand shell or the store brands to what the network marketing programs are selling. You have to compare apples to apples.
So again, I think we're coming back to motive. In other words, are you buying the product because you actually want the product because of the value of the product, or are you buying it just as a token act to meet a quota in a comp plan?
You know, that's exactly right. Again, you're going to find the theme of intent and motive that runs through this component to the analysis, the incidental to participation. You know, it's kind of funny. The FTC's expert witness, Dr. Peter Vandernat, was quoted in the Wall Street Journal Online several years ago when he was talking about pyramid schemes. And Dr. Vandernat is the expert witness that the FTC always goes to in their litigation. And he made the comment that, and it was reported that he made the comment that it's a matter of intent. You know, what is the intent in the purchase? Now, Dr. Vandernat and the FTC have denied that statement. They've said that they were misquoted, and you know, I'm certainly not going to assail Dr. Vandernat on that point. But you know, in my opinion, it is a very critical component to the analysis.
Right. Be he was also quoted, too, as saying that if the distributors themselves are buying the product because they want it, that they count as legitimate bona fide customers. So he gets misquoted a lot, apparently.
Yeah, he's certainly out there, but, you know, you try to hold the FTC to something, and we're not trying to hold them to anything unfairly. We're just trying to get some structure around this analysis ourselves. But again, in testimony, in deposition testimony, he's said that he was misquoted or that they didn't get it right. But there's still a couple more considerations that we can talk about when we're talking about fees incidental to participation.
Hey, Spencer, before you go on to the next two.
Sure.
Going back to that first one, just so people are kind of clear here, when you're talking about, you know, paying to play with a required product purchase, is there a distinction there between requiring a product purchase other than an at-cost distributor kit to simply be a distributor, as opposed to requiring a product purchase to qualify in the compensation plan? And then on that second criteria, requiring that you purchase the product to meet that quota, I think would be a huge red flag. But as long as you can count sales to outside customers to meet your personal quota, so it doesn't have to come out of your own pocket, that would still be okay. Is that correct?
Yeah, you raised two good points here. You know, on the pay-to-play issue or the question, as far as a starter kit, a sales kit, at-cost sales kits are concerned, that is not going to be considered a fee incidental to participation. There's a couple reasons. You know, primarily, it's not commissionable. So you know, that is, since there's no commission paid out of it, you know, it's really not. It doesn't run the risk of the type of abuse that you would see of a product purchase. And so that's really the primary distinguishing factor. And the FTC and regulators understand that yes, if the distributor is going to be successful, there's certain tools that they need and should have. And that's typically what you'll find in a distributor kit. We used to see the hard copy, the binders, the clamshells. We still see some of that anymore. We see a lot of replicated websites and back offices, and you know, it's just a new twist on the old style sales kit. But you know, certainly it keeps up with current technology, and indeed is very valid. So yeah, that's a good point, Lynn. As far as products being, or someone being eligible to participate in the comp plan, if they can generate their sales quota, you know, their PV quota through retail sales, yes, that is something that we typically structure into a compensation plan. I mean, if you have a plan where there's no PV quota, well, you know, from a legal perspective, that would be great, but realistically, you know, you've got to have a PV quota there if people are going to build. I mean,
any direct sales business, the higher quota you meet, the more you get paid.
So. Yeah, you betcha. You bet. I mean, if you don't have any kind of PV quota, then people are, you know, going to tend to sit around and do nothing, you know, to use the term, that you end up with a lot of dead wood in your genealogy, and that doesn't do anybody any favors. You know, certainly your leaders aren't going to want a bunch of dead wood there. Some programs have compression, some don't, but you know, nonetheless, it doesn't do anybody any good. Now, if those people are buying the product, you know, why don't we just treat them as retail customers, and why don't we classify them as retail customers if that's what they want to be? You know, we certainly like retail customers.
Right. I guess the distinction here is that there's, like, I'm not going to mention any names, but there's one fairly well-known company out there right now where they're running some contests right now, and they say to be eligible for this contest and their compensation plan, you have to, your personally sponsored distributors must purchase this product pack. There's no sales to anyone else outside counts. You have to sponsor X number of distributors who purchase this pack, and it has to be their own personal purchases of the product. So that would be legally problematic, wouldn't it?
You bet. Yeah, that would be the classic pay-to-play program. And you know, the FTC would look at that, and they would say, look, that's required product purchases. We, in our opinion, that is simply a fee that is incidental to participation in the plan. And if that happens, well, then you know, we go into court and we fight and argue why it is or why it is not. And
if they just would allow customer sales. In other words, you have to do, let's say, three distributors you got to enroll that do 300 PV or whatever it is, but the PV can be generated by their own personal purchases or sales to outside customers, and you base it on the amount of PV that's created, not the number of recruits. In other words, they could essentially accomplish the same thing by just rewording it.
Well, but you see, Len, there you get into the question of whether or not the product purchases, even though optional on paper, is mandatory in fact.
Right.
You know, you can, and that's really where the FTC and the regulators, you know, they wrestle, and we wrestle likewise with that question.
Yeah, they do use discretion and some common sense. They don't just look at things on paper. They look at how it's being actually practiced out there in the field.
That's right. I mean, we can design a compensation plan so that it is legally bulletproof, but frankly, most of the evidence that the regulators typically garner when they bring a case is done through field investigation. They go to distributor meetings, and they do so incognito. They record them. They take notes. They take pictures. And you never know they're there. And that's where they get most of their evidence that they bring, that they use to bring a case against the company. They're pretty good at that kind of surveillance.
Yeah. And the last point on this issue, and then you can go on to the other criteria. But there's also been some controversy about, you know, auto ships. I mean, obviously auto ships are great, and it's great that we have that option. But if a company requires a distributor to be on auto ship, then that would seem to be almost a purchase requirement. If you have to be on auto ship, then you're not counting sales to outside customers. So what's the distinction between just having an auto ship program and a required auto ship program?
Well, again, a required auto ship program would fall under the category of pay to play. And you know, that is going to be just as dangerous as another, you know, just as a non-auto ship required product purchase. Now, you know, we get some fuzzy lines of distinction here where you're going to look at some compensation plans where they have many, many facets to them. They'll have, you know, they'll have different bonuses. They'll have a level bonus. They'll have bonus pools. They'll have, you know, I've seen some, quite frankly, some compensation plans, and I'm sure everybody on the call has, that are just ridiculously complicated. I mean, to the point of absurdity. But my point is that sometimes one piece or one component to an overall comp plan, one bonus, might be tied to a mandatory product purchase, whereas, you know, participation in all the other facets to the compensation plan are not tied to mandatory product purchases. In that situation, the analysis definitely gets more fuzzy because, you know, the overall program may or may not be driven by these mandatory product purchases or, in other words, fees that are incidental to participation. You know, if you look at the program in the aggregate, you know, how much of the commissions are generated from sales to retail customers, that's always something that goes into the mix. Now, what percentage are driven by internal sales? Of that percentage that are driven by internal sales, how much of that is driven by the auto ships that are driven by this one compensation plan feature rather than, you know, all the other bells and whistles that might be attached to the comp plan? So I don't want to make a blanket statement that mandatory auto ship in every instance is going to render a comp plan a pyramid scheme, but because we have to look at it in the context of the overall compensation plan, look at all of the features to the plan, all of the different bonuses. But it certainly does give the FTC something to talk about if they want to attack a plan.
But yeah, if a lot of distributors just love their own product, they know they're going to purchase it every month because they actually want it, so as a convenience, yeah, we'll sign up for the optional auto ship program, but if I can sell some product too, I know I don't have to do this auto ship order to meet my quota because I've already met it by my sales, but it's just a convenience thing, so I don't have to order it every month.
Exactly.
Something like that, that wouldn't be a problem, right?
No. I mean, if people can, if they're buying or purchasing on AutoShip and they're doing so because they have a bona fide consumer intent, you know, again, that goes back to the intent or the motive element, and that's okay. You know, they have the option of selling it or fulfilling their PV quota through retail customers if they so choose. That's the right way to design a plan.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You said there's a couple other criteria.
There are, yeah. And again, you know, some of these are fairly common practices in the industry that we've all grown up with that suddenly we have to start looking out for. Product giveaways. You know, I certainly know that sampling is something that occurs regularly in the industry, and I don't want to attack or claim that sampling in and of itself is wrong. I mean, let's face it, P&G and Colgate Palmolive, they've been giving out free samples forever. You find them in your mailbox, and it's just a great way to get a new customer. But what I want to address really is abusive sampling. And that is, you know, a company or a distributor, a distributor organization or group teaches their people just buy the products and just give them away as lost leaders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just give them away the product. And what that message is that the product really doesn't matter. All that matters is you fulfill your volume, and then you just give your volume away, and you teach your people to do the same thing. That would be abusive sampling when there really isn't a bona fide consumer intent. You just to use or consume the product. You just giving it away just to as a lead generator to recruit more people. Now, that's something that we would want to be careful about. Now, again, I don't want to tell you that sampling, overall sampling is wrong, because it's not. I mean, if you have some product and you want somebody to give it a try, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, that's a great way to generate a sale. But it's that abusive sampling that we have to be careful and ensure that doesn't infiltrate a program. And then actual product usage. That's something that it would seem that if you're buying the product, you're going to use it. And you know, the samples is kind of a subset of this. But I'll give you an example, perfect example. The SkyBiz program, again, a program that's long gone. We could talk about that one. You know, they were selling replicated websites, and we'd find people that were, you know, because they had to fulfill their PV quota, they were buying their own personal replicated websites month after month after month. There were people that had 50 and 100 personal websites. Well, it turns out that some 90% of the company's websites that were sold were never activated.
Right, and remember, they changed the rule to say you have to activate the website before it'll count, we can pay you on it. All of a sudden, SkyBiz websites started showing up every place where we can tell someone just ran their finger across the keyboard.
Yeah.
It was all the text that showed up on the homepage just to activate it.
It was silly. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And so that's an obvious case where you know, the product was not being used, and it was clearly just a facade for participation in the compensation plan. So those are kind of some bullet points on what constitute fees that are incidental to participation. I wish I could say it was a comprehensive list, but you know, things keep popping up as new cases are brought by the FTC or regulators. So it's you know, there is no list that you can go to as a definitive source. It's just, you know, you look at a program and look at what's going on and analyze it and figure out, okay, what's really going on beneath the surface here? Why is that product or service being purchased?
Yeah, plus you have to go by, because there is no MLM law per se. There's anti-pyramid laws, but what we really have to go by is just legal precedent. We have to look at a lot of cases that have occurred and kind of get an idea of really where the line is based on just legal definitions that have been made case by case over time, which even sometimes are even contradictory from state to state, let alone on a federal level. But
well, yeah, I mean, we certainly have you know, the differences in approaches between the various circuits, federal circuits, and certainly we have roughly five different approaches taken by the states. Some of the state approaches are close to one another. In fact, very similar, but some are quite divergent. You know, we have a dozen states right now that specifically permit and concede that personal consumption of a company's products by its sales force is appropriate. And those 12 states really stand apart from the rest. The other states just aren't nearly so permissive. Now, we're certainly working to get more states on board with that internal consumption permissive model, but it's a slow process. You know, we're keeping our fingers crossed that Nebraska will come on this year, but I don't know. Don't know if that's going to happen or not.
And it's not to say that the other states have specifically said they don't count. Most of them are just moot on that particular point. But are there any particular states that specifically say personal consumer products by distributors don't count and are not commissionable?
No, they don't. None of them come out and say it in such specific terms. You know, they all go back, and we can talk about internal consumption and retail sales if you'd like. That's certainly a factor that goes into the mix and of a pyramid analysis, and it has played a very important part since 1996. But the states don't get that specific. They have to look to precedent, as you just mentioned, Len. And again, that can get pretty fuzzy even at the state level. Now, I have found that the states I've dealt with tend to look at things on a more cut and dried basis than does the FTC, and retail sales tend to be something that they will latch on to very quickly, simply because it's an easy item for them to focus on, rather than drill down into the whole fees incidental to participation analysis and the other factors that go into a pyramid analysis.
Well, before we leave that subject, because I do want to get kind of back to the 70% rule and really what that means, but
sure.
Just still getting with that incidental to participation, one of the common things that we've seen throughout the industry, which is coming back again right now, and again, I'm trying not to hit any particular company or niche, but the issue with there are certain types of products and services that are very good, very valid, but they just don't lend themselves to network marketing because there's no margin on them. Like literally, in some cases, there is zero margin. The value of the product is the value of the product. Or if there is a margin, you know, like travel or long distance or whatever, it's a very small margin, not enough to really support a competitive comp plan. So what a lot of these types of companies will do, and there's a variety of different niches that they fall in, but they compensate for that by charging an upfront fee of several hundred dollars, which they call a training fee or something like that. They'll deny anything's paid from that, but the bonuses that are paid are sometimes in excess of the actual cost of the product. So clearly it's got to be coming from those sign-up fees. If a company does derive any multi-level commissionable sales from something only a distributor would purchase, like an application fee, a training fee, sales aids, a website that's used for promotion of the opportunity, anything like that only a distributor would purchase, those should be, as I understand it, not only not commissionable, but sold by the company at cost. Otherwise, the company's making money by the act of recruiting. Is that correct?
Mostly. First, to be properly commissionable, a product must be retailable. And you're absolutely right, Lynn. The question is, if the only people who would have an interest in purchasing something, you know, typically a sales tool, a replicated website, you know, copies of the company's catalog, for example, if the only people that would be interested in purchasing that product or that tool are going to be your distributors. And so if there's no retail market for the product, then it certainly should not be commissionable. Now, the question of can you make a profit on sales tools, the answer to that would be yes, you can make a profit on sales tools. What you need to, as long as the tools are optional, and again, I mean optional in fact, in practice, mm-hmm. not just on paper. But you know we want to charge an ad, when you charge for a starter kit sales kit, which can include a replicated website, for example, the reason we want to charge at cost for that is that we have to get into the business opportunity laws. There's 24 states and a federal rule that have what are known as business opportunity laws, and I don't want to go into too much detail there because that's going to be off topic for tonight, but. Just to summarize, if you charge at cost for the starter kit, in most states, the cost of that starter kit does not count towards meeting the business opportunity threshold. There has to be a minimum investment threshold that's satisfied before the import of the business opportunity laws kick in. And that the threshold ranges from $200 to $500 per, depending on the state. If the starter kit is sold at cost and it's below a certain amount, that does not count towards meeting that threshold. So that's one of the main reasons we want to sell it at cost. Other states have in their anti-pyramid statutes provisions that an at-cost starter kit is okay, but that's just a small minority of the states. But we're going to get way off topic if we start
right.
going into
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I'm more talking about like when you join, you get the kit. So let's say you pay there's a $500 franchise limit, so most of the time you see $495. That's like the highest you'll see a company charge. And you get a kit, you get the website, you get the back office. It's $495. Now, most companies are charging $20, $30, $40 for that. So you got to, you know, the widgets incorporated. I'll keep this as generic as possible. $495 to get in. Now, the widgets themselves have no real markup, per se, not enough to support a comp plan.
Right.
And whatever that
right.
widget might be. But if you can get three customers to buy a widget, you get a $300 bonus.
Right.
And your sponsor gets a $100 bonus. Now, clearly that can't come from the widgets. It's got to come from the $495. If there were no $495 fee, that coding bonus or whatever they call it wouldn't be able to occur. But they'll claim nothing comes from the $495. It's an advance commission on widgets or whatever their explanation is and the rationalization is for it.
Right.
In those kind of situations where it's pretty clear mathematically and logically it's coming from the $495, that would be a legal red flag, correct?
Absolutely, yes. That's the kind of case where the FTC's lawyers would get the company's accountant on the stand and watch them sweat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if your margin on your product is razor thin and you're paying out a big bonus on the starter kit, which is at $495, of course. I mean, it's very obvious and apparent where that money's coming from. And so, yes, that looks exactly like what it is, an enrollment fee or a recruitment fee, which is one of the principal indicators of the pyramid scheme.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do want to say, hopefully, even time for just a couple of questions at the end, too, but I'm going to have to kind of rush here because I do want to also get to income claims and product claims.
Well, we've just scratched the surface here. We haven't really gotten into the...
Just real quick, as far as the 70% rule, the main thing I wanted you to really clear up for is there's a lot of people out there, either people that are just sincerely ignorant or, ignorant doesn't mean stupid, it means ignorant. They just don't have enough information. Or they're what I call anti-MLM zealots that are deliberately misquoting this. The 70% rule does not say we have to retail 70% of our product, correct?
Yeah, let's talk about the 70% rule because there's so much confusion surrounding that rule and I've heard at least 15 different iterations of it.
Mm-hmm.
Can I give you a little bit of an historical perspective on the 70%? And I use the rule loosely, or the term rule very loosely here.
Mm-hmm.
The 70% rule was born from the old Amway decision. In the middle 1970s, the FTC brought a case against Amway. Among other things, they claimed it was a pyramid scheme. The case actually wasn't decided until 1979. But in its defense, and Amway was successful in that case, they did prevail. They said that they had three rules in place that served to A, deter inventory loading, and B, promote retail sales. The three rules were, first, they had a 10-customer rule. That is, the Amway distributors had to certify that they'd sold products to 10 retail customers each month. They had a 90% inventory repurchase policy, so if a distributor quit, the company would repurchase their remaining inventory less a 10% restocking fee, so they'd pay them back 90% of their net cost. And then they had the 70% rule, in which, and under that iteration of the rule that Amway had, the distributors certified that they had resold 70% of their products before they ordered more product. Now, remember, this is the 1970s, before auto ship programs and before there was computer tracking systems. The way Amway worked was that a direct distributor would buy product and they would sell product to their front line. Their front line would sell it to their front line and so on down the chain. So you had distributors buying and selling product to their downline. Now, you know, if let's say that I had sponsored Len and Len placed a $100 order in a month, and I went and I had placed the $300 order. Among that $300 was Len's $100 because he had to order through me because he was not a direct distributor. Automatically, there's one third of my order I that goes towards meeting that 70% rule. So that's the way that Amway had it set up, and that's the way that the rule was born. What happened after that is that network marketing programs looked at the Amway case and they said, oh, Well, Amway had these three policies in place, and the FTC held that they were not a pyramid scheme. So if I put these policies in place, that represents a safe harbor, and I won't be a pyramid scheme either. Well, that's not quite how the ruling came down. The ruling actually said that in that case, as applied to those facts, Amway had proven that it actually had those rules and it enforced those rules, and that they were in fact effective in deterring inventory loading and promoting retail sales in that case. So essentially, you've got to make sure that you're enforcing the rule if it's going to do you any good. Now, we've seen a lot of companies that have the rule and don't enforce it. And in fact, it's my opinion that if you have the rule and don't enforce it, it's going to do a company, it can ultimately do a company more harm than good. But that's a different issue. So the question then becomes, all right, we have this 70% rule. First, understand it is not a rule of law. It is just a rule that Amway had in place back in the 70s that they proved was being enforced and was effective in deterring inventory loading and promoting retail sales. So the import here is that a company does not have to have a 70% rule if it's going to be legitimate. What they do have to have in place are some form or system by which they promote retail sales and deter inventory loading. Now, again, we're talking about inventory companies now, not about service companies or companies that are offering digital products.
Mm-hmm.
But again, there's plenty of inventory-based companies around still, lots and lots of them. So you're going to want to look at a program and ask yourself, are there processes or procedures in place to deter inventory loading and promote sales?
Right, so the 70% rule is basically to make sure it doesn't stack up in your garage. You've got to get rid of 70% of your previous orders before you can buy more product. And even though it is called sometimes a 70% law, it's not a law. It was a policy within Amway.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And it is designed to make sure the product isn't just stacking up. But we do need to clarify that and make sure that we underscore the fact that not only can it not stack up, but it has to be distributed to bona fide consumers.
Right, right. And also, and what's happened now, too, is because of specific precedences that's kind of working against us now, these what I call anti-Mone zealots, they look at some specific cases where the FTC has said, okay, this, like Jewelway, for example, we'll remove the TRO, we'll let you back in business if you guarantee 50% of your volume is going to non-distributors, which, of course, was a death knell on that company. But nonetheless, they kind of threw the book at them and put a 50% retail requirement in there, which they've done to, I think, Five Star Auto Club and a few other cases. So now the anti-members are going, see, they want 50% of the product to be retail. Now, we know that the DFA asked them about this in January of 2004. The FTC wrote a letter and said, no, we go by the motive, not the percentage of people that buy product. These were exceptional cases, or we threw the book at them. This, I think their exact words were, this does not represent the current state of the law. But nonetheless, that's kind of went viral now, that somehow the FTC requires 50% of the volume be sold to non-distributors. So can you clear up that misconception?
Yeah, I sure can. In fact, the FTC has specifically declined to identify a percentage of sales that is appropriate to render a program legitimate and not a pyramid scheme. That question again came up in the last deposition of Dr. Vandernat that I was in on, and the FTC has not identified a specific percentage, and nor will they do so.
Yeah, I think what they're saying is, it seems like from that DSA letter, for one thing, is that most of the product could be going to your distributors as long as they're buying it because they actually want it.
Yeah, the FTC's looked at this, and they've identified what would be classified as a buying club type organization. That is, are you offering your distributors are they joining because they get a discount on the product and it's a great deal, and they're really just consumers, and so they'll look at that and take that into consideration. But again, here's where it can get muddy. I mean, you can have distributors, and I can think of several programs where the consultants or distributors are just buying the product month after month. They're not out recruiting or building an organization, have no intent or desire to do so, and they're truly acting as just buyers of the product. And you ask yourself in those cases, well, why wouldn't that type of a program be a, just a buying club. It sure sounds like it. And indeed, they, in many cases, it should be. But you have to go back to why did they get into the program? Did they get into the program to in order to purchase the products at the discount, or were they getting in and buying the products because they were enticed to do so with representations of income? And so you really, you go back to the initial transaction when in the recruiting process. How were people pitched? Were they pitched on the products and told the benefits of the products and told that if you join and you can get the products at the deepest discount, best price, and that's the way to go? Or were they pitched on how much money they could make, and you know, that was the driving factor in getting them to enroll, and then once they enrolled, then they just figured out that, hey, this building a business is more work than I was led to believe or than I thought it would be. But by the way, I still like the product, so I'm just going to stick around for the product.
It's also, I guess, besides the how did you enter question, I guess maybe it just as valid would be to ask yourself an exit question. In other words, if everybody out there would ask themselves, if I stopped doing this business, would I keep buying these products? And the answer is no. I'm going off auto ship the moment I quit this business. I think that would be a good gut check. Now, if I say, no, I won't do this business, but I would stay on auto ship because I love these products, you're probably in a legitimate company with a legitimate product.
Yeah, that's a good point, Lynn. And it's tough to get data to quantify that. You know, you really have to. How do you get inside of somebody's head? That's why.
Well, like a question each individual distributor can ask themselves. Well, what is
right.
my motive for buying these products? Now they'll all say, "Well, I joined because it all sounded so great." But the big question is, if you quit, would you keep buying the product?
That's a very important question. Very important question. I mean, the bottom line is. Ask yourself, I always ask clients, you know, will your product continue to sell even if there was no compensation plan associated with your program? I mean, if you were to take your product out and just sell it on the internet, or just introduce it to retail shelves, would it still sell? And would it sell at this price? Or is the only reason it's selling, or is it the only reason it's selling at this price because of the promise of income that's attached to it?
Yeah, there's an old question that I remember back in the early mid-90s, which I haven't heard recently, but I think it still applies. The question was, can the last person in still make money? So if you were the last person to ever join your company as a distributor, could you realistically still make money in the opportunity by buying the product and reselling it? Whereas if the last person in could only make money if they recruit another person, then that would be a red flag. And I think we also, since we need to make a distinction too, in that if a company has a whole bunch of legally commissionable products, but they have, 10% of their commissions are coming from sales aids or training fees or distributor kits or whatever, because I've seen this happen a lot where I'll go to a company and I'll say, well, most of your products are perfectly legal, but you're paying commissions on your distributor training. And they'll go, well, yeah, but most of our products are not distributor training. So I ask, how can the last person then make money? Well, from the other products. I'll say, no, wait, I mean from your training fee. How can the last person then make money? Well, they can still sell the other products. They keep going back to that. So the analogy I use is they're kind of like saying we have a pharmacy and 90% of what we sell are legal pharmaceuticals and 10% is crack cocaine. It's okay to sell the crack cocaine because 90% of what we sell are legal pharmaceuticals. So I guess the point there is if any commissionable aspect of your compensation plan is such that you have to recruit to make money off of it, it doesn't make any matter what the other aspects are. That's a point that could get you hit.
Well, that's right, because there's nothing – well, the regulators can look at a comp plan and break it down into its component parts. Now, that's where the legal eagles start to argue, and as I said, the program gets muddy. What is the source from which commissions are being derived, and what is primarily driving this program? But the point you raised, Lynn, it goes back to the question is, are these fees incidental to participation in the plan? And in the scenario you just described, yes, absolutely. Those training fees or sales tool fees, charges, those are absolutely incidental to participation in a
group. Right. And if they say, well, some are, some aren't, the some that aren't doesn't get you off the hook for the some that are. Pretty much everything should be commission. Everything that's commissionable should be something that isn't incidental and has a retail value.
And that's right. That's what we want to ensure, that you know, you're not being foisted on, or a bunch of sales tools and materials aren't being foisted upon the consumers. That are really just these internally driven tools, and there's no retail market for them whatsoever. And again, we just come back to the fees incidental to participation question.
Right. Now, I know we only have at least 5 minutes for some Q&A here, so I guess in the next 5 or 6 minutes, as far as the products, and this gets a little off the pyramid issue, but I do want to focus on the FTC's relationship to our products here. The FDA, as far as what we can say, what are disease treatment claims and things like that, that actually I want to make a subject for another whole call. But where the FTC comes into play here on our products, as I understand it, they want scientific substantiation that we're telling the truth about our products, not so much how it's classified, you know, drug, dietary supplement, whatever. And in that sense, we got some crazy stuff out there right now. And again, I don't want to pick on companies, but just to give you an example, one that came across my desk the other day was this company selling, literally, Spencer, they're selling a magic wand, like a wizard, like a magic wand. You wave it over things, and there's all these miraculous stuff. And what causes the wand to have its power, if you go to their website, the way they describe it is exactly how Obi-Wan Kenobi described it to Luke Skywalker. The force behind the power of this wand is literally, you know, Star Wars is the force. So this is the basis of their MLM company. There's another company, you know, of course, the nanotechnology patches, and there's several companies selling that now, or the ionized water, catalyst water, what we used to call Willard water, all these types of products. I'm not saying there's circumstantial evidence they work. I'm not even suggesting they don't. But as far as the FTC now, they're going to want scientific substantiation of that. What is scientific substantiation, and how far do anecdotal personal testimonials lend itself to satisfying that criteria?
Sure, you bet. Yeah. Now we're getting into the specific realm of dietary supplements, and you're correct, Lynn. The FTC, the FDA, and the FTC look at two different things. Although the FDA has jurisdiction over both, the two categories are labeling and advertising. The FDA takes primary jurisdiction over labeling, and the FTC takes primary jurisdiction over advertising. And advertising, when they look at advertising, their approach is, can you substantiate the claims that you make about the product? Is there competent and reliable scientific evidence to support the claims that you make? Now, you talk about anecdotal evidence or testimonials. You can, quite frankly, have a dump truck load full of testimonials, and it won't do you one bit of good. Testimonials and anecdotal evidence do not constitute scientific evidence. What does? Well, that's at least an hour conversation, at least an hour conversation. But you know, to just touch on it, you have to consult with experts in the specific field and the experts in the specific field would have to look at the scientific evidence that you have in your possession and say, yes, this supports that statement or that claim, or no, it does not. Now, you look at some of the claims. Let's take the product cures cancer claim. What is the degree of substantiation that is going to be required to support that? Well, you know, look to the drug field. How much does Pfizer or Merck or any of the other big drug companies, how much did they spend on their clinical trials to prove that a product, a drug, will cure cancer? Well, it's many, many millions of dollars, and the rigorous trials that they have to go through with those clinicals they're huge. Well, if you're going to make a claim that a dietary supplement is going to cure cancer, again, putting aside the FDA issues there, just looking at a substantiation issue or a substantiation approach, a company is going to have to go through those same clinical trials and have scientific support that meets those rigorous standards. And dietary supplement companies just don't do that. You know, the money's not there, and if, even if they were to undergo those types of trials, then that would cause them to be categorized as drugs anyway. And most
right, yeah. It's like I always say, even if you do substantiate your claims to the FTC, the FDA is going to come in and say, what you've just substantiated is you're selling an unapproved new drug.
That's right.
Classified. If one doesn't get you, the other one will.
Yeah, the fact that you're treating or you're testing it on cancer patients is indicative that it's that you're dealing with a drug here.
Right. And the thing is that, and just so people know, one of the reasons why all the testimonials in the world aren't going to do you any good is because the placebo effect is a very, very powerful thing. My brother has Crohn's, and I was following a drug that was supposed to have a 60% remission rate, complete remission rate, and it was going through phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 clinical trials. It was in phase 3. Ultimately, the drug was not approved, even though they proved a 60% remission rate. Why not? Well, because the placebo group also had a 60% remission rate. Of Crohn's disease, 60% remission, and they got a sugar pill. Placebo effect is powerful, a psychosomatic response, or whatever you want to call it. So you got to do so much better than the placebo group, which is why you need these double-blinded, clinically controlled studies, you know, to really have scientific substantiation.
Yeah, exactly. That's correct. And also, let's face it, when we're dealing with you know, individuals trying to sell a product, you know, they have a vested financial interest in selling the product. There's an inherent bias in any testimonial that they provide, and you just can't escape that fact.
All right. And one last question about products I want to ask you before we open this up for some Q&A is that, and this is just something I've kind of personally been going around with for a while now on some message boards, and maybe you can clear this up because it does affect quite a few companies out there now, not just one or two, so I'm not picking on any particular company, but the issue of sublingual or transdermal products. And as crazy as this sounds, because I don't agree with this, it sounds ridiculous to me, but the FDA rules, if a product is absorbed through the lining of the mouth, under the tongue, between the cheek and gum, or through the skin, transdermal, that alone makes it ineligible to be a dietary supplement. That makes it basically a drug by its form of administering into the body. It has to go through the digestive system to be a dietary supplement. So all these companies out there, and there are several, that have products that are either patches you put on your skin or you hold it under your tongue between your cheek and gum or whatever, aren't those problematic based on the FDA regulations?
Well, yeah, the FDA has taken the position that, and under the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, yes, the dietary supplement has to be ingested. You know, there are several cases out there, primarily the nasal spray cases that are on the books, that those products, they were spray vitamins that were, you know, nasal sprays, and yeah, it's a great way to introduce it into the body, but they did not meet the definitional element of a dietary supplement that it has to be ingested. And
right.
Transdermal, again, the same situation applies there. The sublingual question, that's a little closer call. I mean, is sublingual absorption part of the GI tract? I've had some doctors tell me that it is, and others argue that it isn't.
I got a direct response from the FDA on that, because one company, their response back to me was,